I'm very excited to be talking about this topic because this topic is my dissertation topic. I'm doing my dissertation at Columbia with Professor David Weiss-Halivni and Professor Suzanne Stone and Professor Michael Stanislavski. All their first names are professors. And what I'm going to be doing today, or what we're going to be doing together, is we're going to be studying a certain type of rabbinic loophole found in the Gemara between 60 to 70 times. It's called Ha'arama. And before we go into the sources, and sort of the way I plan to do this is because we have time, which is a blessing. Because we have time, what I want to do is I want to do this piecemeal, meaning people will do chavrusa on a few of the sources, then we'll actually discuss them in depth and get people's opinions, and I'll try to take us sort of a bit further than what the sources are telling us. And then the next group of sources and discuss, meaning I want to get to a gestalt, but I want to get to the gestalt by people really working on each piece. Because given that, again, this is a dissertation, there are actual different pieces to this. We're not just going, you know, for one concept, we're going for building. So I want to talk about Ha'arama for a second, the term Ha'arama. It's spelled Hey Ayin Resh Mem Hey. The first thing is, any bells go off in terms of what the word might mean? Devious. Now, actually, if everyone could say their name when they speak, because this way, we definitely can. You're the second person to ask that. So we can. Do you want to start us off? Rebecca Winter, related? She looks like you. Compliment to both. Okay, so why do you say that you think Ha'arama means, what was the word you used? Deviance. Devious. Orma, because of the word orma. The first time we have the term used as sort of cunning or tricky, the serpent, the nachash, the snake, is Arumikol Chayata Sadeh, right? He's cunning. It's a negative term. By the way that Chazal used the term Orma, or Darshan, the term Orma in the Gemara, is a negative. Having Arma or Armumiyut is looked at as sort of a power that is somewhat dangerous because you know how to manipulate. It's sort of a manipulative term. Now, what's interesting here is that in these 60 to 70 times, and what I mean by 60 to 70 times showing up in rabbinic literature is I literally mean across all of rabbinic literature. So I mean Mishnah, I mean Tosefta, which we're not sure exactly if the Tosefta is the same time as the Mishnah, perhaps later than the Mishnah, perhaps earlier than the Mishnah, but it's somewhat contemporaneous. The Talmud Bavli, the Talmud Yerushalmi, and even Midrash Halacha, even Midrash Agadah, meaning Midrashic stories as opposed to Midrashic Halacha. So throughout all of that. Now, if Ha'arama has this negative connotation, as you say, just by looking at the word, do you think it's something that's looked favorably upon or not? It's a trick question. Sometimes it's allowed and sometimes it's not. Which is interesting in and of itself. If you're going to allow something, why are you giving it a negative term that's associated with it? What are you trying to tell me? Are you trying to say it's allowed but don't take advantage of it? Why is it you? So I want that question to be in the back of people's minds, okay? What I want you to look at now for as many minutes as you need, and I really want people to analyze, so don't just look through and say, okay, we've covered the basics. I really want people to analyze the difference between these three sources that I want you to look at first. 1 through 3 are very pivotal sections that tell us what Ha'arama is, okay? And I don't want to plant ideas in your head, but I want to see what you come to in terms of differences between the three sources, what each of these sources tell us about Ha'arama, okay? So I'm going to give people time to do that. If you want, do it by tables, do it by pairs, whatever makes you happy, do it by yourself. I highly recommend doing it with other people because the conversation will naturally bring up more analysis. Okay, so take a look at 1, 2, and 3, and we're going to reconvene, okay? Question, have people really, people feel comfortable with sources 1 and 2 already, correct? So it's source 3 that either people have finished or are up to now, right? So in the interest of making sure that we get to everything that we get to, that I want us to get to, is it okay if we start working on the sources together? Yes. 60 seconds on the clock. Okay, so here's my question. Starting with this question, can someone explain to me how Ha'arama works in number 1? How does it work? How does the circumvention work? What's the mechanism? Yeah, sure. Wait, just say your name if you would.
Rivka.
Thanks, Rivka.
There's an omission of the full information, and therefore the person who's doing the redemption has to work on basic assumptions or is entitled to work on basic assumptions.
What's omitted in terms of information?
That it's my master.
Do you think, I'm just pushing you a little bit, do you think that the person standing with you doesn't realize that it's yours? You're giving them money. So the thing is, there's nothing else that can be redeemed. So if I'm standing with a bunch of food, and I say to somebody, here's some money, redeem it, they know that it's Maaser Sheni, right? Which is, you're pointing out something very important, which is everybody knows what's going on here. It's very important. That's a very important point. We stumbled upon it. It's a very important point. So how does it work? What's the mechanism? Well, who says we pretended? Okay, so the Torah says that if I redeem my own master, I have to pay an extra 25%. Doesn't say anything about anyone else. This is the way you have to say it to the person. Redeem this tithe. You may not say, redeem it for me. Why can't you say, redeem it for me? They're your shaliach. They're your agent. And we say, shlucho shel adam kemoto, a person who's your agent, it's as though it's you, and they'd have to give the 25%. So what is the mechanism here? This is important. It's important because it starts to work with categories. Yeah, Ellen, right? You are transferring ownership to the person of the coins. That's why you can't do this with minors. You can't do this with minors because their money is your money. With your little kids, their money is your money. Believe it or not, once they hit 12 and 13, their money is their money. Tell that to my parents and my bat mitzvah money. Right? I am still bitter. It's okay. I think they probably used it for my wedding, if I had to guess. Right. It does not. It's saying you can even use a member of your household. The implication is that you can even. It doesn't say even, but the implication is that you can even. This is something that showed up already in Roman law way earlier. It's called interposita persona, putting another person into the equation. Happens all the time in Roman law, happens all the time in Jewish law, right? I'll give you another example. Selling your chametz on Pesach, which is not Ha'arama, selling your chametz for Pesach is an interposita persona. You're not allowed to own it. Who says it needs to be destroyed in the world? Your chametz needs to be destroyed. If it's someone else's, does it? This is something that is used over and over and over again, introducing a new person into the equation. Okay? And I think it's very important what Rivka brought to our attention, which is everybody knows what's going on here, but I'm not allowed to say it as shlichut. I'm not allowed to make the person into my shaliach. This is super duper technical. I'm giving them the money. What would happen if the person ran away with the money and didn't do what I said? Could I prosecute them in court?
No.
No, I could not. I gave them the money. This was a legal, valid, legally valid transaction that took place. They are allowed to run away. Does it look to you, in number one, that this is l'chatchila, that this is something we're being told to do, or does it look like a bidieved, like if you did it, it's okay? Why did you think it's bidieved? In terms of the way it's presented, though, in this Tosefta, the presentation, ma'arimin means we con, right? We manipulate. That's what it means. It means we manipulate. And then it tells you how, right? We manipulate how? Like this. Well, why are you calling it, why are you saying it's ma'arimin if this is something we do? Why is this permissible? And even the way it's being presented here, l'chatchila. Okay. It's an interesting example. Two, how is the second ha'arama effectuated? How does it work? Yes. What do you say your name? Do you mind?
Shana.
Thanks, Shana. That sounds great.
But when I get it out, it's too scrawny, I discovered to my amazement, so I need to get out the second animal.
So let me ask you a question. So everybody has seen this source. What exactly is the loophole? Is it that I'm changing my mind, meaning that I earnestly want to eat this animal? Right, I earnestly want to eat this animal, and then I earnestly decide that I don't. Right? Is that what's happening here?
I don't think so. I've been installed pre-test, and I began with the intention of rescuing both animals, and that this is just what I.
So says Shana. This is not actually about what you're thinking. It's about what people think you're thinking. By the way, this source in the Tosefta says that you don't have to shecht either of them in the end. The version of this that we find in the Gemara, both of them, says that you have to shecht one of them, which is interesting. That could change the way you think about what this is really, what's really happening here, right? Yeah, this is the first time we have a machloket, right? If we want to talk about whether this is l'chatchila or b'dieved, whether this is something we do or something that if you did it, it's okay, there's a real argument here. Rabbi Yehuda says, what are you doing? You can only take out one of the animals. That's life. You can't shecht both of them because they're a parent-child pair, and the Torah says, otoved b'no lo tishchutu b'yom echad. You can't shecht both of them. You can't have someone else shecht them either because according to otoved b'no, you also can't have. They can't be shechted in the same day. You can't have somebody else do it, so you can't do interposita persona. There's nothing you can do. And Rabbi Yeshua says, no, I have a great idea. You think Rabbi Eliezer hadn't thought of that idea? No, he disagrees. He doesn't think it's appropriate. Something's off about this. Do you see a major difference? If Shana is correct, okay, that what we're talking about here is not really what's going on in your head, but what people think is going on in your head. These are two very different types of harama, right? The first type is totally legally valid, completely legally valid transaction. The person can run off with the money. The second one is what people think is going on in my head and isn't. Or maybe it's what people think is going on in my head and it is going on in my head, but there's nothing external to prove anything. Okay. So then what is this?
This is just a little mind game.
What mind game? What exactly am I doing? If I'm sitting in my backyard by myself and this happens on Yom Tov, what am I doing now to get this animal out? Am I literally looking at this animal and saying, looks delicious, let's take it out? And then I take it down and says, actually, and say, it actually doesn't look great. That one looks delicious. I'm going to take it out. What, literally tell me what I'm doing. What am I supposed to be doing at that moment? Right. So am I thinking? Am I changing my thought? Good morning. Am I changing my thought? This is very strange. Okay. This is very strange. The other one is super clear cut. So straightforward. Right. You see the difference between the two. I almost have proof. I have evidence for the first one. It's a totally external action that's recognized by a court. People might say, well, your motives are suspect, but it doesn't matter. I did everything technically by the book. And the second one, no one can prove whether I did something technically by the book or not. So you're saying I have to say something?
Oh, okay.
Right? Meaning what is going on? Is there a bubble coming out of my head saying what I'm thinking? Right? Try to put yourself into those shoes. Are you saying that? Are you thinking that? If nobody else is around, are you thinking that? If you're thinking that, what's the purpose of thinking that? What is the purpose? What are you accomplishing? Yes, Shana. Well, that would be nice if we had that conversation, you know, in the ensuing sections, but we don't. But we don't, right? I want to just point out, so right now, we're living with two big questions, I think. Number one, we're living with why you're calling something harama if you're allowing it. Number two, we're trying to understand these two different types of harama. The first one is definitely more straightforward. The second one, you really have to struggle to figure out exactly what's going on. Even if you call it a mind game, why does it work? How does it work? Right? Meaning, calling it a mind game still doesn't explain to us how it works. Okay? So we're left with that. Number three, I want to look at number three with you because I want to show you something that's very interesting about harama. The fact that we have a lot of rabbinic dodges and circumventions, and you can name a lot in Jewish life. Examples. Okay, so having somebody turn on a light for you if it's dark, keeping in mind that that's something that has to have particular, right? There are constraints around that. Selling your chametz. Interest. The whole idea of also not canceling debts at the end of the Shemitah year. So we do a prosbul instead. Eruv. Right? Eruv Tavshilin. All these things. So why aren't all these things called harama? Right? Doesn't harama means manipulating the law? So I want to show you, I want to look at number three for a second. Did everybody get through number three in the end? What number three does is it shows you the difference between harama and a rabbinic takana, a rabbinic decree. Eruv Tavshilin, let's explain what Eruv Tavshilin is for. I am not allowed to cook on Yontif for Shabbos. The reason why I'm not allowed to cook on Yom Tov for Shabbos is because the rabbis are worried that then I'm going to cook on Yom Tov for Chol, which would really be inappropriate, okay? So therefore they say, you know what, we've made this new rule that you can't cook even for Shabbos, and we're going to create a mechanism whereby you can. That mechanism is start your cooking for Shabbos before Yom Tov ever begins. So you've already started your cooking for Shabbos, and whatever you do on Yom Tov is sort of a continuation of that, but really you cooked on Chol for Shabbos, right? That's why you don't eat the Eruv Tavshilin, you don't eat the cooked and the baked item before Shabbos. If you eat the cooked and the baked item before Shabbos, you can't cook anymore for Shabbos. Because I thought you were cooking the meal for Shabbos. You also don't have to eat your Eilif Tafshilin on Shabbos. You don't have to eat it either, which is interesting. You can, but you don't have to. Once Shabbos starts, you can. So what we're looking at here is a rabbinic decree. The rabbis had a rule, and they gave you a way to remember their rule while also being able to live practically. Okay? Erev is the same thing. An Erev is not for a biblical prohibition. An Erev is because, and it's not really the rabbis, this goes all the way back to the time of Shlomo, but the Erev deals with the fact that basically the rabbinic decree was, it's not just things that are considered biblically public reshut, reshut harabim, public domain, that you can't carry in on Shabbos, but we're also going to extend it. Any shared domain, we're going to say, even if it's not a place where 600,000 people reside, okay, which is the model for the public domain, because the Jews were in the desert, they were those, the public domain, right? When they were moving stuff for the Mishkan, they were moving it from the public domain into the wagons. The public domain was defined as a place where 600,000 people, times probably 2.5 at least, right? 600,000 plus people were residing. That's a biblical public domain. Rabbinically, they said, no, any shared space, we're going to say, you can't carry there either, because we are worried that, honestly, who's ever going to be in a biblical public domain? You're not even going to remember that this is a law. So we're going to say, shared space is also off limits for carrying. And not only shared space, but sort of big open spaces that are not used. You know, like a big open field or something that's not used, okay? So what did they then do? They said, okay, but practically people can't live like that. And how are you going to go and move and bring your kid and go eat with friends? It's just not going to happen. So they said, we're going to create this thing called Eruv, which means combining or mixing. And Eruv is going to be everybody is agreeing to share this domain as though it's under, you know, one major corporate heading, sort of. Okay? Again, that's very controversial in my country right now. Again, what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with the rabbis made an extra decree, and they gave you a mechanism by which to remember their decree and at the same time live practically. Okay? Major difference in this Gemara between that and Ha'arama. What's the example here? The example here is, should have done an Erev Tafshilin. You didn't do an Erev Tafshilin. Okay? So instead, or you ate it already, right? So instead, what do you want to do? You want to do a harama. All in your head, you want to do a harama. Here I am, on Yontif, I'm cooking. I end up cooking a little extra. I happen to use it for Shabbos. Am I actually cooking a little extra for Yontif? Or am I cooking for Shabbos? You have the same problem. You have literally the same problem. And this is called harama. Right? This is not a takana that they're making that you can cook a little extra. This is something where you're personally trying to get out of a situation that you are stuck in. And this was not an inevitable situation. You didn't have to come to this situation. This was not, there was nothing inevitable about this. You should have done an Erev Tafshilin. You shouldn't have eaten the food. Not you. You know, a person shouldn't have eaten the food. And Rav Ashi is super against haramas. And he says, oh, harama is even worse than doing something on purpose, breaking the law outright. Terrible thing. Rav Ashi in general, when you look in the Gemara, he's very against haramas, especially of this thought type, okay? What this Gemara does, one sec, what this Gemara does is it shows you the difference between what the rabbis call harama and a takana. A takana of the rabbis deals with systemic issues. It is a systemic issue. It will hit you in the face one Shabbos, the next Shabbos, the next Shabbos, the next Shabbos, if you're not allowed to carry in the shared domain because the rabbi said you can't. So they need to give you a way to deal with this. It's going to come up no matter what, year in, year out. Prizbal, it's going to come up every 7 years that you're going to have to cancel your debts and people are not going to give each other money anymore because they're not going to get paid back. So the rabbis have to figure out a way to deal with this systemically. Heter Iska, helping us take interest. Systemic problem. Jews are going to go to the poorhouse. It's not going to work without being able to take interest. So they say, systemic problem, systemic answer. Harama is not that. How many people you think in their lifetimes will have their two animals that happen to be a parent-child pair fall into a pit in their backyard? How many people in their lifetime are going to not do the Erev Tavshilin? And by the way, not realize that everybody who does an Erev Tavshilin says, my Erev Tavshilin is for everybody, right? Not do it. Oh, okay. Not do it. Exactly. But who's to say that at that point that's what they were doing? So how many people are going to get into that situation? This is very situational, incidental kind of stuff. Ha'arama, by definition, is the incidental moments. How amazing is it that the rabbis not only are working on the systemic problems, but they're even working on the random issues that confront me, myself, and I maybe once in a lifetime? That is cool. We don't have that. You don't have that, in other systems of law that come later. You don't have that concern for the individual and license for the individual to use their own little mini takana, right? And I'm worried to use the word takana because it's really not, right? That's pretty amazing. So when we talk about, rabbinic circumventions and dodges and things like that, we're talking about two totally different worlds. They're giving me my own personal dodges that I can use myself, and even some of them that I can use just in my head with nothing to prove what I'm saying. That's pretty wild. That's pretty wild. By the way, no wonder it's called Harama. No wonder it's called Harama. We're not dealing with something that's out in the open, that's public, that's a systemic issue that the rabbis are making a decree about. We're dealing with something that is on a personal basis. I'm in a jam. I need to figure out how to manipulate the halacha in this particular situation so that I can get everything done, and we'll see what some of the motivations are, that I can get everything done and things can work out okay. And they give me my own, but they say, by the way, realize you're manipulating the law. We're not trying to change the law here. We don't want everybody to start throwing their animals into pits and taking them out on Yontif. We don't want everybody to necessarily, I know she's saying, but the first one looks like it's lechatchila, right? We don't want everybody to be doing, X, Y, and Z by calling it Harama. It gives it this is an incidental kind of thing. Okay, so your question, Ellen had a question first, and then we're going to go to that. The first case is different. What's the motivation in the first case? The first case is you can do Harama on Maser Sheni. Right. This one kind of looks like a takana. I want to ask you a question. When did this even come up? When did the rabbis start talking about this? Were people still doing Maser Sheni when the rabbis brought this up? Kind of hard to know, because if we're dealing with the Mishnah, it's also in Midrash Halacha, but if we're dealing with the Mishnah, we're in the 3rd century. It's not happening as often. But an important open question, and we will get back to it. Okay? So here's what I just want to give you a quick introduction, sort of the next piece. Okay? So the first thing, again, just to reorient ourselves. We've seen, number one, that when we're dealing with circumventions, we're dealing with circumventions on a systemic level and on an incidental personal level. Number two, we've seen that even within Harama, there are two types of Harama. One is a legally valid action that's externalized and clear and can be upheld in a court of law. And the other one is something mental that we don't necessarily understand. What I want to do is I want to move to motivations for Harama, because guess what? We already looked at two sources and, two examples of Harama, and in one it seemed like, sure, go for it, and the other one, there was a machloket. So what is it that allows or prohibits Harama? So I want to show you first, I want to introduce you to some concepts in secular legal theory, okay? First and foremost. So number four, it actually starts on the next page, but I'm going to skip that anyway. I want to talk to you about legal positivism and natural law theory, okay? First of all, is anyone familiar with those two things? Okay, great. So you can chime in if you want. When we look at secular law in general, secular law has been viewed, I mean, in many different ways, but two major schools of thought as to what law is about or how law is supposed to work are positivism on the one hand and natural law on the other. I'm going to start with natural law. Natural law, I'm going to read Ronald Dworkin, who's a contemporary natural law philosopher who works at NYU. I'm going to read that in number 6 and then, you know, sort of expand a little bit. It says, law and justice are identical so that no unjust proposition of law can be true. That's a very extreme version of natural law. But basically, and natural law comes in a few different versions, but basically natural law says law has to be moral. Law has to be moral. So sometimes, even if a law on the books says something, if a principle of law or a value of the law contradicts it, there's a discussion to be had there. Okay? Not only that, he also says, you know, places like Nazi Germany was not a legal regime, according to his perspective. That's part of how the conversation gets started, that it's not a legal regime because it's not moral. Law is really supposed to be the human being's way of trying to get to ultimate principles of morality, okay? So if morality plays a role, it means it's not just the black and white, you know, what's on the pages of the law books. But it's also, what are the ideals that the law is striving for? And I'm going to give you an example. In the late 19th century, there was a really amazing case called Palmer v. Riggs. The story went, and this was in New York, of course, because crazy things like this happen in New York. Somebody was, he was set to be the heir to his grandfather's will, and he murdered his grandfather to get the money early. Okay? So this case came to court, and they're looking at it, and honestly, legally, by the books, he has a right to the inheritance. Even if he goes to jail and they hold it in escrow or whatever they're going to do with it, he has a right to inherit. But the values and the principles of the law include, you know, a sense of a person should not profit from wrongdoing. And he didn't end up getting the money. Okay? He didn't end up getting the money. That's sort of a natural law way of looking at things. It's not just the technical things that are on the books. It's also, what's the morality? What are the principles? What are the values? What are we trying to get at in terms of bettering society? Positivism, which also comes in many forms, positivism does not include morality as a prerequisite for law. Positivism says, law is law. If we wanted law to be morality, then we wouldn't call it law. And by the way, there would be many different types of law. There would be many different versions of law because everybody has their own version of morality. Law has to be something stable and unchanging, and it can't sway with the wind of what you think morality is and what you think morality is and what you think morality is. We have to establish a system. So that's positivism, okay? Now, H.L.A. Hart, who was the father of modern positivism, number 5, the simple contention that it is in no sense a necessary truth that laws reproduce or satisfy certain demands of morality, though in fact they have often done so. Right? Meaning sometimes there is an overlap between morality, but it's not that it's incidental, but that's not what makes it law. It's law because it's a stable system, and that's what we've decided, and that's the way it goes. And there are certain guidelines for how you make a law. And Nazi Germany was a legal regime, right? He's before Nazi Germany, but it's a legal regime. These are two major ways of looking at law. When we talk about a loophole or a circumvention, who do you think is more excited about circumventions? The positivists, it's what's on the books that count, or the natural law theorists who say we're looking for morality? What do you think? Throwing it out to you. Who's pro? Who's more pro?
Okay. Who's pro? Positivists are pro because they're not interested in the moral structure behind.
It's technically valid to give the money to someone else and have them redeem your maaser.
Yeah.
What is the issue? What's the problem? That's the law. Move on. What about natural law theorists? Yeah, Rebecca? So let's talk about the reason. Oh, let's get Joyce, right? Yeah.
The question to me is, what is the overarching reason for this implementation? That being to create a moral society. And in that sense, mind police, rabbinic or otherwise, dealing with thoughts being on a moral basis, even with harama,
right,
is what you're looking to achieve. Because if you have moral human beings, you have, by definition, and default, a moral
society. It's four loopholes. Within context. So let's talk for a second about the motivation of these ha'aramot. Okay, and I want to get back to the question of, it seems like the ha'arama about Ma'aser Sheni is a systemic. What is the reason why these two ha'aramot are being allowed? You know, one, unanimously in number one, and two, by Rabbi Yoshua in number two. What is the reason? Why is it being allowed? What is the subtext? Why is this being allowed? Okay, so she says, what do you mean? Who cares why this particular loophole is being allowed? In general, we're positivists. That's it. So you would expect Rabbi Yoshua to always go for Ha'arama, right? It's okay. Rabbi Yoshua is the one who says you can do the Ha'arama in the animal case. So you want to see Rabbi Yoshua always go for Ha'arama because this is a positivist versus, I don't even know if we can say versus natural law, but it's a positivist perspective. Rabbi Yoshua says, the law is the law is the law is the law. You're following it. You're changing your kavana, as far as I know. I can't prove otherwise. So what's it my business to try to prove otherwise? And good. Go for it. No problem. We right? And Ravashi, by the way, number three, hates Ha'arama. So he says, I'm not a positivist. That's not my interest. I'm something else. Yes. Right.
So let's be realistic and let's say, let people stay within the legal framework and still fulfill their obligations.
So let's take a look at number seven. Number seven is Louis Brandeis, who, a member of the tribe, who was a realist, okay? And he says, I live in Alexandria, Virginia, near the Supreme Court chambers is a toll bridge across the Potomac. I don't know why I always miss, I always do a comma there. I don't know what my problem is. When in a rush, I pay the dollar toll and get home early. However, I usually drive outside the downtown section of the city and cross the Potomac on a free bridge. If I went over the toll bridge and through the barrier without paying the toll, I would be committing tax evasion. If, however, I drive the extra mile and drive outside the city of Washington to the free bridge, I am using a legitimate, logical, and suitable method of tax avoidance. The tragedy of life today is that so few people know that the free bridge even exists. All right, let's take this into just a very practical context. We are dealing with practical issues here. We need a way that people are not going to lose all their fruit or lose all their money or, you know, lose their animals. And let's understand that this is allowed. Okay, but within limits. If you look at number eight is not even talking about Ha'arama per se. If you look at number eight, Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Rabba Bar Chana said, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, name Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, name Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, which means this is going back very early. Okay, this is three generations of people quoting the same quotation. Bo ure'e, come and see, shelo kidorot harishonim, dorot ha'achronim. The earlier generations are not like the later generations. Dorot harishonim, the earlier generations, machnisin peroteim, derech hashar haroshi, the traksimon, kidei l'chaivan b'maser. The earlier generations, they wanted so much to give maser that they would always make sure to bring their food in through the door that the Torah says makes you have to give maser, which is the front door. Okay? If you bring it through the skylight, you don't have to. It's a technical loophole. Okay? But exactly. But dorot ha'achronim, machnisin piroteim, derech gagod, v'derech karfifot. But these later generations, what do? They bring their fruits in by the, you know, in the, through the skylight, through the yard, kidei lefotran min ha'maser, so that they don't have to give the maser. So what are they upset about? They can't say the loophole is not okay. They can't say the circumvention is not okay. They're technically okay. But we don't like what you're doing, and we don't like that it's so widespread. We don't expect it. We don't want it to be so widespread like this. Okay? Un momento. Okay. What we're going to do now, and we will, don't worry, we're going to put everything together, sort of all the questions and everything. What I want to do right now is I want to probe some of the suggestions that people have made. So I want people to take a minute or however many minutes and look at number 11, okay? If people could learn it b'chavrusa, I think that would be great, looking at number 11. And actually, the truth is, you can read both 9 and 11. I actually think that's important to read both 9 and 11, okay? And then we'll reconvene. Okay, let's reconvene. And the question that is on everyone's mind is, what is wrong with bringing another something to catch the, you know, shemen, oil, whatever it is that's falling off your roof, right? Even water. So the issue is, the Gemara says they're worried that you're going to start bringing vessels, and you're going to bring a vessel through the public thoroughfare in order to, you know, bring something. You're going to break a roof. And we can think of a lot of other things, you know. Let's say it happens in a place where there is no Eruv, so we make sure that you never do it. But the point is, the Gemara actually says, and I just looked it up because we were just talking about it in the back, just to make sure that I was sort of on exact target. The exact thing that the Gemara says is, we're worried that you're going to bring, you're going to end up bringing a kli, a vessel, through the public thoroughfare in order to do this, right? Which might be remote, but this is the rabbinic decree that's made. So what we're looking at here is, we're looking at two... guests make it all right, because I'm not going to keep bringing. I'm just bringing enough for my guests. I'm not crazed with trying to save all of my stuff. And also, maybe that issue outweighs the fact that, you know, I might bring it through the Rishut HaRabim. Guests, it seems to me, there's a counter pressure for why I need to save the food or the shemen. I think it's just pressure, counter pressure. In other words, shouldn't do it because we're worried that you're going to end up bringing. Just take as much as you need. Don't bring another kli and another kli and another kli, because you're going to get so hysterical trying to save all of the shemen that's coming out that you're going to end up even bringing through the Rishut HaRabim, not thinking about it. But the point is, if you're just saving, you're not trying to save all of it, you're just saving what you need, so you're going to be methodical about it. I understand your question. It's an important question. I'm not, you know, waylaying the question. I'm just saying it seems like the logic here that... understood the question. Still the same answer. Meaning, either what we're dealing with is just pressure, counter pressure. In other words, there's a reason why we don't want you placing vessel after vessel, unless you need to. Meaning, if you have guests, you need to. Right. Oh, I didn't make that clear. Okay. Exactly. So, but I understand what you're saying, which is, well, if you're really so hysterical in saving the stuff, you're going to be just as hysterical if you have guests, if not more. But it seems to sort of be working in a pressure, counter pressure kind of way. You know, meaning there's pressure not to do it because we're worried that you're going to be trying things that are not allowed. And then there's the counter pressure of, but you actually need this shemen for today, so we're not going to make a rabbinic decree that's going to destroy your Shabbos plans. You know what I mean? But it's not an exact, I don't think one is answering the other as much as it's saying we're not willing to make a rabbinic decree if you need the stuff for today. You see what I'm saying? So, good question. Yeah.
The issue is that you need that oil that happens to be dripping, or is that you don't want your guests to be slipping all over the front porch?
Like, you need the oil. I'm saying oil, but, you know, fill in wine, fill in water. You need it. You need it. Well, so they're saying that you can't save more than you need. The truth is, if you bring an original kli that's pretty big, you're okay. But here it seems to be that it's overflowing what you need. And they say you can't bring more because Gezera decree, we're worried that you're going to end up bringing through the Rishut HaRabim. But if you have guests who are coming, we're going to let you save for the guests. Well, you're not allowed. You're not allowed. But we're not going to let that worry stop your Shabbos plans. You know? Because anytime there's a rabbinic decree that's being made, they realize that it's an imposition. So they're only willing to impose so much. They're only willing to impose so much depending on what your plans are. So in this particular situation, they're not willing to impose if it means that you then can't serve your guests. Right. Right. Yes. Sheena, yeah.
It seems to me that it is about the law. Because it says you can't collect the drip and then invite the guests. In other words, you're primarily motivated by making sure that you're not going to have a whole barrel of oil or wine or whatever flow into the dust, into the dirt floor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it seems to me that the person who's vaguer is being analyzed here is motivated by the desire to save, and then the guests become the pretext. The guests become the horror.
And you're allowed to invite the guests first and then save. What's being said, or the machloket, the argument is, can you save the stuff now? I was going to invite guests and then invite them. Right? Meaning it's that mind... It's that mind game again, right? And there's this machloket about it. And then the Gemara says, well, maybe this is like the machloket, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. We've already seen a machloket about this. And this is where it gets very interesting, because we had said before, well, maybe different people have different positions. You know, Rabbi Yoshua is always pro Harama, and Rabbi Eliezer is always against Harama. But here that falls to the wayside, because the Gemara says... No, maybe Rabbi Eliezer only barred the Harama option because there was a way to take care of the second animal in the pit. It wasn't necessary. He only uses Harama where necessary. And maybe for Rabbi Yoshua, he's not gung-ho, I'm a positivist, let's go for Harama all the time. It's in this particular case, the animal is suffering. You can't let the animal suffer. You can't let the animal sit in there in the pit under the hot sun and... You have to find a way to get it out. So there you have the discussion moving much more to what is the motivation here. And you mentioned the motivation being loss of money or materials. It seems like the Gemara is saying maybe Rabbi Eliezer would allow Harama here. Because in the other case with the animal, I could at least make sure that the animal is okay. You know, I'll put a shade over it. I'll do something. But when it comes to... This, without the guests, you're not going to save your oil or your wine or your water. You're not going to save it. So maybe he's willing to, depending on the motivation, maybe he's willing to help us out. And knowing that it's like a last resort, if it's good motivation and there's no other option, then we'll do Harama. Right? So it does throw a monkey wrench into the whole thing. Right? People see that, right? Everyone's being very quiet. People see that? So you're saying don't take this as, we are necessarily saying that this is the way it works, that people are not on, you know, different sides of an issue depending on the particular scenario. That's a suggestion that the Gemara is making to sort of destroy this. Well, this machloket, it must be like this machloket, right? Here's the only problem. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua themselves, we have another case where they say the opposite things. Meaning, I'm not even bringing that case just because I don't necessarily want to get hung up on the particular case. The particular case is a little bit involved in terms of Pesach and being able to burn truma that has become tameh. So all that stuff being super, you know, relevant to what we do every day, I figured we might not want to get hung up in it, you know, as much as Maaser Sheni is relevant to what we do every day, although it is when it comes to produce from Israel. So what we're dealing with here is, yes, a suggestion that maybe there's more to this puzzle, and also other places where it seems to say there's more to this puzzle. It's not just I like Ha'arama, I don't like Ha'arama. It's very scenario based. And by the way, that sounds to me a lot like naturalism, as in natural law. What's the motivation here? What's the particular situation? What's the value? It also sounds a lot like realism. Let's look at what's real. It does not sound a lot like positivism. If halacha is just positivist, and for those who missed it before, positivism is, it's not the values and principles that make law law. Law is what's on the books. It's stable. You want law to be morality, you're going to end up with 300 different versions. Can't do that. So if that were the case, then anytime you're technically following the law, it should be fine. But that's not what we're seeing. That's not what we're seeing. So I think this is already giving us a sense that the motivation is very important. Whether there's a different way to do it is very important. Ha'arama, again, has that negative connotation of manipulating. It has that negative connotation. We don't go for that first thing. There has to be a good enough reason to be doing it. Okay? I want to show you one more thing. 12 and 13. And by one more thing, I mean two. I want to show you 12 and 13. Because I think this is a great way to bring it to one more level. We have done a lot of good work here today. I have to say, it's really, I mean, I'm the happiest person in the world because this is what I do all the time by myself. So I'm very happy to share it with so many intelligent, interesting people. And people who ask good questions that I might not have thought of. Like, well, why is it that this overrides the question of bringing through Shudder Rabbim, right? Meaning these are things that I might not have thought of when I'm sitting by myself reading this. So thank you. So we've the outline up until now that I've suggested. Number one, there are different types of Ha'arama, some clear cut, some mental, less clear cut. We're not sure what they're about. Number two, there seem to be takanot that the rabbis make to deal with systemic issues that are in the public eye, that are totally usable, that are great things, that are rabbinic power at its best. And then there's this thing called Ha'arama, which is an incidental situation that I need to get out of personally because I have a problem that they really don't want me to use necessarily, but I'm allowed to use in certain circumstances. And then we move on to the question of, well, why am I allowed to use it? Is this a case of positivism where, all right, as long as you're following the law, it's fine, no matter what your motivation is. Is this a case of natural law, where we're saying it's the morality, it's the motivation, that's what we care about. These are values of the law. Values of the law, you know, HaTorah Chasal Mamonam Shel Yisrael. The Torah cares about Jewish money. The Torah doesn't want us to lose all of our money. Tzar Balei Chaim, want to make sure that animals don't get hurt. You know, these are things that are values in the Torah. Tzar Balei Chaim also may be an actual biblical law, but they're also things that are values in the Torah. Or are we talking about realism, where it's, look, we've got to figure out what exactly is going on. How can we make this work? We haven't really dealt so much with the realism point, and that's what I want to end with today, which is we have these amazing two examples, and we're going to read them together if that's okay. We have these amazing two examples of people doing Ha'arama, and the discussion that follows is a very realism-oriented discussion. Okay, so number 12, okay? Amru le Rabbanan le Rav Ashi. Remember, Rav Ashi is the one who doesn't love Ha'arama, and especially mental Ha'arama. He's the one who says Ha'arama is worse than doing an Aveira on purpose. Okay? Amrule Rabbanan LeRavashi. The rabbi said to Ravashi, Chazi Mar, you know, our master should look. Hai Tzur Vamei Rabbanan, this young Jewish scholar, V'Rav Huna Bar Chevyan Shmei, his name is Rav Huna Bar Chevyan, V'Amri LeRav Huna Bar Chelvan Shmei, some people say his name is Rav Huna Bar Chelvan. Whoever it is, there's a young scholar who does the following. Deshakel Bara Detuma. What he does is he takes, I mean, this is wild. He takes a clove of garlic, umanach bebarza dedana, and he puts it, okay, and we're dealing with, like, on Shabbos. He puts it in the hole of a barrel, okay? Va'amar, and he says, la'atznuei kemechavina. I just want to put the clove somewhere. I just need to put the clove somewhere, and here happens to be a place where it fits. Well, what am I doing then? I'm fixing the barrel on Shabbos. I happen, come on, right? And this is a classic case of you can't prove anything. This is my mental process. And he's even saying it in front of other people. He's saying, I just want somewhere to put the cloak. But not only that, he does other things too. V'azil v'naim b'mavra, he falls asleep on a raft on Friday, va'avar lahach gisa, and what he does is he falls asleep on the raft, and the raft crosses the river on Shabbos, v'sier peire, and he goes and he looks in on his orchard to make sure that his peirot are doing well. So he's crossing the river on Shabbos, which he's not supposed to do, which is a rabbinic decree. He's not supposed to cross the river on Shabbos, and he's looking at his peirot, but it's just because he fell asleep there on Erev Shabbos. Come on. Come on. Everybody knows what this guy is doing. This is not believable in the least. This is less believable than saying, I'm going to shech this animal today. Right? And this is amazing. Va'amar, and he says, Analaminam kamechavna, I'm just sleeping. I just fell asleep. Exactly. Amar lehu. And Ravashi says to them, Ha'arama kamrit. He says, really, are you complaining to me about Ha'arama? It's Ravashi. Are you complaining to me about Harama? First of all, Harama b'dirabonanhi. We're talking about Harama against rabbinic decrees, or maybe he's saying Harama is always only used against rabbinic decrees. Harama is in rabbinic decrees. V'tsurva me'rabanan, and a young scholar, lo ati l'me'evad l'chatrila, is not going to break the law on purpose. In other words, he'll keep doing this way. He'll never outright break the rabbinic law and go on a raft across the river. So what's the purpose of the Ha'arama? What's the purpose of mental Ha'arama? So how fascinating. Is he actually circumventing the law if everybody knows that he's lying about his intention? Okay, so what we have here is, we were talking earlier, and Shana brought it up, and Rebecca brought it up, and now you're bringing it up. Can you remind me? Thank you, Sarah. Now Sarah brings it up. The issue may be that when you're talking about Ha'arama, that is mental, we can't prove either way what you're doing. The rabbis are giving you license almost to break the law, but in a way that shows respect for the law and keeps you from breaking it outright. Okay? Keeps you from breaking it outright. So you sort of need two things to be at work here. Number one, we need to be able to say that what you're doing is legally okay. Right? Meaning, what you're doing is legally okay because we can't prove otherwise. We're giving you that ability. Now, what you're thinking in your own head is a different question, which I still don't know the answer to. And the second thing is, we need to make sure that this is sufficient for you not to just think that the law is something flippant that you can just break whenever you want. This is a particular allowance for purposes of parnasa, for money, for not losing your... What a fascinating example. Now, notice, that's for the scholar. I would not be allowed to fall asleep on the raft on Erev Shabbat and go look at my pay road across the way because I'm not in the category. So now you're telling me it's not just different scenarios where Ha'arama might be allowed or might not. It's different people and how it could impact their psyche. I need to show you this last example first because it's just going to enrich the conversation that much more. Take a look in number 13, okay? Amar Rabba Bar Rav Huna. Rabba Bar Rav Huna said, Ma'arim adam al hamishmeret biyom tov, litzlot ba rimonim. A person is allowed to use cunning to stretch a mishmeret, which is like a filter, like they would put a cloth over the top of the wine so that when you pour out, the dregs don't come out, okay? What you do with that is, they said, you can do that and put, you know, pretend that it's because you want to put pomegranates there. And the way I'm describing it is not actually correct because it's not a bottle. We're talking about something that's wide, like over a barrel or something. And what you can do is you can use it as a, what's it called? You can use it as a, like a counter space, like a basket almost, okay? Vitole bashmarim, and in the end, you can filter wine through it, okay? Which is an interesting thing, right? Meaning the point is, what do you mean? That's only on there because I need the extra, I need somewhere to stick the rimonim, right? I don't know if that there's aeration that happens there, and that's sort of the positive of putting rimonim over a barrel. I'm not really sure why that would be a normal use of the top of a barrel, but let's assume that that's, you know, there's a reason why a person can do that, okay? But the point is, what you're doing here is, at the very least, there's a machloket, there's an argument over what the problem is with what you're doing. But at the very least, what you're doing is you're creating, let's say, an ohel, some sort of structure, okay? You're creating some sort of a structure. We'll start with that, okay? Amar Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi says, "Behu detala barimonim," but you know what you have to do first? You have to actually put pomegranates there. Of course, Rav Ashi says that, right? Meaning we're seeing Rav Ashi as. By the way, Rav Ashi is 6th century. He's late. Not 6th century. He dies in. Where's Chana Lakshin when I need her? He dies in. Sorry, I had to do that at least once. He dies in. Ravina dies in 501, I think. Rav Ashi dies in 459 or something. 5th century. Okay, they're 5th century. So, but he's the 6th generation of Amoraim. He's like the end of the road. Okay, I'm going to get in so much trouble if my dissertation advisor listens to this. Just cut that part out, David. Okay. V'hu d'talaba rimonim, make sure that you make it look real. Okay? Or make sure, not just that you make it look real, but that for yourself, it actually is a way of keeping you from breaking the law outright. In other words, you have to actually do something that is going to tangibly feel like I'm doing it differently, so that you remember that this law is still a law. My shnameha. Well, what's the difference between what you're telling me to do, Rav Ashi, that I have to put the rimonim in, from the following, Ditanya, the following brayta. Mitilin shechar b'moed letzorech hamoed. Chol hamoed we're talking about. I am allowed to start making beer, wine, whatever, for Chol HaMoed, on Chol HaMoed. Shelo l'tzorech HaMoed, asur. But I'm not allowed to brew beer for consumption after Chol HaMoed. Right? There are actual rules of Chol HaMoed that we try to keep. Right? We're not talking Halacha L'maaseh right now. But we try to keep to within the holiday. Echad shechar tzmarim v'echad shechar se'orim, whether we're talking about date wine or barley beer or whatever we're talking about. Af al pi sheyesh lahen yashan. Let's say you have old beer already. You don't need anything more. Ma'arim v'shoteh min hachadash. You are allowed to be ma'arim and make new beer, wine, because we know that you're going to use it. Even though we know you're going to use it after the holiday, okay? And you don't have to drink the whole thing up on the holiday, okay? Well, what's the difference between those two cases? In other words, why does Rav Ashi say, no, you have to actually use it for its purpose when you're trying to effectuate Harama X? And for Harama Y, the Braita never told us you have to use it for its purpose. Now, what Shotem Min HaChadash means, it sounds like you have to take a little sip of the new wine, but I guess it's different from having to actually drink the whole thing or drink a substantial portion. What this Gemara actually means is a subject of tremendous debate. But what I'm very interested in is the last line. Well, here's the difference, says the Gemara. Hatam lamucha milta, hachamucha milta. In one case, it's not obvious what you're doing. In the other case, it's too obvious what you're doing. So you have to change it. Wow. People sometimes want the newer beer. So sure, I'm brewing it. I'm going to drink it on Chol HaMoed. I don't end up drinking it on Chol HaMoed, so I don't end up drinking it on Chol HaMoed. But people who see don't think that I'm just doing a ploy to make new beer for after Chol HaMoed. If I'm doing this whole Rimonim thing, come on, you're really... But if I actually put down pomegranates there, makes it more believable. Makes it more believable. So now you're telling me Harama is not just about what my mental process is and how it keeps me from doing an Avera outright, but it's also what does it look like? What does it look like? I'm assuming to other people, right? What does it look like? We're concerned with what it looks like. Wow, that's pretty interesting, right? It does enrich the conversation. Yes. Oh, I probably, when I originally did that, I was just talking about Chol HaMoed. And it could just be that we're talking about date beer, but I think I just did that because I was trying to explain what Chol HaMoed was. Yeah. Yeah, good call. That was sharp. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, so here's the issue. Here's what we're back to. Here's what we're back to. If we want to talk about realism a little bit, we got a lot of realism thrown in there, right? Meaning who it is, who's watching, what they understand when they're watching. Let's go back to our original two basic issues. Original two basic issues, one was systemic versus personal incidental, right? That was one. That's a kanot of the rabbis, decrees of the rabbis that are out in public, that are, you know, perfectly accepted and acceptable. Those are things that deal with systemic problems that, by the way, those systemic problems were induced by rabbinic decree to begin with, right? And you can't carry here because the rabbi said you can't carry here. Right? Now, Prusbul and Heteriska are a bit of a different category. But the point is, there's something legal barring, and they're creating something legal to open it up, and it's a systemic problem. Harama, I suggested, is something that is incidental, something that doesn't happen all the time. I want to stick with that suggestion. The reason why I want to stick with that suggestion is there are two ways that I think we can defend it, even in the face of Ma'arim and Al-Ma'aser Sheni, the original being allowed to do Ha'arama in the case of Ma'aser Sheni, where you have to bring the food to Jerusalem, and if you don't want to bring the food to Jerusalem, you have to redeem it with money, and if you want to redeem it with money and it's your own food, you have to redeem it with an extra 25%. Nobody wants to lose that tax, so ask somebody else to redeem it. Don't say redeem it for me, just say redeem it and give them the money, and nobody has to pay the tax. That sounds systemic. Two things that I think we can still defend. Number one, I think the rabbis didn't want people using this all the time. I think the assumption was that we're dealing with people who can't afford the extra 25%. That's number one. I think we're dealing with people who can't afford the extra 25%. Carrying on Shabbos, everybody is going to have that problem. This is not a socioeconomic issue, right? Prusbul, again, everybody's going to have the problem of not getting paid back. Heter Iska, interest. Everybody needs to take interest in order for the economy to work. This is not something that is dependent on socioeconomic status. Harama, time and time again, socioeconomic status becomes the issue, and by definition, that makes it very subjective and somewhat incidental. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I have to tell you, the only two places where we see that Harama... Yeah, I think I can say this. The only two places where we see that Harama is brought as a lechatchila in a systemic way is in the Mishnah. The only two places. everywhere else, the Tosefta, the Gemaras, everywhere else, it is not used in any sort of systemic way, which makes me think that perhaps the Mishnah uses the term Ha'arama differently than later texts. This is one. The other, and this is the only two instances that it shows up in the Mishnah at all. The other is for a Bechor, for an eldest born animal, that if a person knows that their female animal is giving birth to an eldest born, and they can't afford to lose that animal by giving it as a korban, because they also promise to give a different korban, what they can do is, while the animal is in the womb, they declare that that animal is the original korban that they wanted to give. So they kill two animals with one declaration. Pretty cute, right? Meaning, those are the only two places, and they both seem somewhat systemic because a lot of people have Bechor issues. But at the same time, I think you can also see that what we're dealing with is somebody who can't afford to give a second korban, which is very odd, and someone who can't afford to give an extra 25%, which is also very odd. It's very unlikely if somebody has that amount of produce that they don't have that amount of money to pay for it. Do you know what I mean? Right.
And it's really the
poor people who are what's very interesting, and this is a very important point that you're making, and actually David Dalby, who writes about Roman loopholes and Jewish law, he also makes the same point that even back in Roman times, because he says it a little differently, which is, what do poor people do? They just break the law. Right? Meaning they don't have a choice. I think what's interesting is that Ha'arama, I think, is made for people who are in difficult circumstances. It's not made for the rich. Ha'arama is made for... Okay, I totally understand that, and I don't think Chazal wanted that. I don't think... That's not the impression that I get. I think this is actually made... You know, if we want to talk about actually being merciful and caring about the populace, this is actually made for the people who are in the most difficult circumstances, who need to save the money the most. Right? Right. 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 Not necessarily. So that is a very important point. And I am making an assumption, but the reason why I'm making it is because it seems over and over that money seems to play a role. You know, you don't want to lose all of your shemen. You don't want to lose your second animal. You don't, and it doesn't seem like the rabbis would be creating or allowing a Ha'arama, which they consistently say is sort of a last ditch effort kind of thing for people who have 1,000, you know, members of their little cattle ranch. Right. People will take advantage. People will take advantage. But the question is, what was the original intent? So I actually I'm on tape. So the last thing, I think the last thing I'm going to say, so I'm going to try to stick with the difference between Ha'arama and Takana, and sort of say that Takana is something that's public systemic for everybody, and Ha'arama is something for someone in difficult circumstances, but I think I'm going to add, it's for people in difficult circumstances who are often the most underprivileged, which I think is a pretty important thing to add. And sort of changes the way that we look at Ha'arama. The other thing that I want to say is that it seems that Ha'arama, sort of the fact that it's not always allowed, and sometimes it's allowed, sometimes it's not allowed, and depending on who you are and things like that, I think the question of what Ha'arama is really doing, I'm not always sure that what we're dealing with in Ha'arama is just legally following the law, or if what we're dealing with in Ha'arama is how we show respect to the law, even when we have to get around it in some way. And it makes me wonder, in general, this mental type of Ha'arama is what sort of leads me to this discussion of, are you really getting around the law, or are we just letting you get away with it because you're showing that you care about the law and it's only rabbinic, so the rabbis are giving you an out, they're giving you an opening. But we want it to be in a way that keeps the stability of the law and keeps a measure of respect, that you're never going to violate it outright and other people are not going to see you doing it and think, oh, well, this is not a law anymore. I can do whatever I want. You know, is it possible that this is a loosening of the rigidity, but at the same time, it's a maintenance of the structure in the same way? And it makes me wonder also about the haramot that are very clearly valid and objective, like giving money to somebody and having them do the Maaser Sheni. It makes me wonder also, why do we try to technically follow the law so much? I think one of the things we're trying to do is we're really trying to maintain the stability of the system, even while giving people room in the system. So the very extreme way of doing that is to allow somebody to literally lie to themselves, but it's reminding them how important the law is, and everybody who sees them doesn't think they're breaking it and think, oh, this is just a flippant thing, it doesn't matter. And the less extreme form is technically follow the law so that, you know, this is actionable in a court, not a big deal. I gave somebody money, they gave, so my motivations are suspect, but I literally followed the law, and that somewhat becomes paramount, not because the letter is more important than the spirit, but because without keeping a sense of the letter of the law, there's just too much chaos. Without keeping a sense of the letter of the law, they're worried that they're going to lose the authority of the law, which is not such a crazy anxiety. Meaning the notion of, well, why don't we just change it? Why don't we just, they dafka don't change it, right? Meaning, why don't we just change it? Ipso facto, by default, it sort of changes because we're not, you know, throwing out all of our chametz. We're just not. So why not just change it? And there's a sense of we don't want to change it, meaning we want to keep the stability of it while loosening the reins a little bit. So I think it's somewhat of a provocative thing to think about, because the first time I encountered loopholes just as a kid or just living in a modern Orthodox place, it's just the sense that I got is that people are so cynical about them. Like, what is this? Yeah, like, oh, come on, what are we really doing? And I think the point is we know what we're really doing. But what we're really doing is not just circumventing a law. What we're really doing is we're trying to keep a structure, an infrastructure intact that has a sense of authority, that has a sense of stability, while still giving people room to live. And that happens at the systemic level with takanot, and that happens even at the personal level with ha'aramot. And it's very sensitive. And I'm sure that there are many people today who say, well, I'm not so interested in the stability of law. But that does descend into something at a certain point. And do people want to descend into that? And I think this is very sophisticated stuff from very early on. And I hope it gave people food for thought. Thanks so much for participating. And you all definitely gave me really good things to think about. So I'm pretty excited about that. Thanks. And thank you so much to Rebecca Rotenberg-Nadler, because she's really sort of the person who got me to come to Toronto. You know, she was like, you should come. And to her emotion, she's done a lot of stuff for this. So I really appreciate it. And also Malka and Ellen made sure that my baby had food to eat this morning. So I really can't thank you enough. I would not have made it. Have a great day. That's a wrap. Totally my pleasure. I just want to write a few things down before I do that. Yeah.